This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, the consequences for African Americans who choose exotic names, the treatment of disabled inmates, and Russell Simmons' question for hyping the value of his businesses. Joining us from our New York bureau is Robert George, editorial writer for the New York Post. Deborah Dickerson, author of The End of Blackness, is at WGY Studios in Albany, New York. And in our Chicago bureau is Roland Martin, executive editor of the Chicago Defender. Welcome, and let me just jump right in here. Russell Simmons, Businessweek called him the CEO of hip hop. He co-founded Def Jam and Fat Farm, sold them both for a lot of cash, now runs businesses from a beverage company to a cash card. But in a court deposition last year, he admitted he'd inflated Fat Farm's sales figures. He said that Fat Farm was doing $350 million in sales on CNBC. Turns out that its revenue was $14.3 million. So how's he going to afford the gold toilets for Kimura, Robert?
good question. Let's just hope that Kimura doesn't get too upset when she realizes that their bank account isn't quite as fat as she thought. Obviously, there's a lot of kind of puffing oneself up, to use a phrase, in the hip hop world. But Mr. Simmons, I think, is running right on the lines of committing a certain kind of amount of fraud. I mean, if this was a fully public company, he'd be facing a lot of securities investigations right now.
Well, Deborah,
fraud?
Roland.
Maybe there are two words here: Donald Trump. I mean, how many times have we had to listen to his statements about how he's worth $4 or $5 billion and his company is this and this and this, and they never can seem to pin down exactly what his real worth is or what his companies are really supposed to be doing. I mean, Russell Simmons is correct. What he is in the hype business, and that's what it is. I mean, sure, it is also a fault of journalists to allow someone to come on to a show saying, oh, yeah, well, my company does $350 million, and you hadn't done any research to actually double-check what that company actually does. And so he's been allowed to get away with that by weak-minded and lazy journalists.
Well, it seems to me that the whole hip-hop industry has, kind of put itself on layaway. All this bling is coming at a cost. Deborah?
I think that the issue people are trying to raise is that since he's putting himself out there as a social activist, he has a responsibility to be, honest and tell the truth in all his dealings. I think that's this. This story struck me as it must have been the product of a slow news day. And he's been wearing his businessman's hat. You understand that these people are engaging in puffery when they say that their companies are worth $350 million. When people say that, describe my books as bestsellers, I don't say anything, but I know that they're not. So I don't say that they're bestsellers, but I allow other people to say it. So I think that the trying to conflate his role as a business person and his role as a social activist is where this tension is coming from. And I don't think this is the kind of issue that needs to slop over from his business life into his role as a leader.
Definition of hip hop. I mean, it's really not. I mean, sure, you could talk about the focus on bling and hip hop. But again, I mean, I use Donald Trump as exhibit A. I mean, we listen to all of his pronouncements of the greatest building, the greatest golf course, make so much money, all of this nonsense, when in fact he is not one of the best businessmen out there based upon how he runs his Trump casinos.
Well, Roland, let me just ask you to follow up on what Deborah said. She said that it doesn't affect his ability to do kind of social issues work. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I would disagree based upon, I believe you must speak truth. If you're going to speak truth to power as a social commentator or an activist, you should also do so in your personal dealings, even if it's your business. And so it does go to the veracity of the individual. So I think you have to be credible. But again, you're talking about someone who is transitioning from a life of hype in business to a completely different arena.
And this is especially true if he is creating some, say, charitable foundations, for example. And as we've seen in previous scandals involving charities, the front person, it has to be really kind of really scrupulous in their dealings with the public, because that's when you're really starting to you're really asking for people's trust that their money is going to be used used appropriately. And so, I mean, I think he has to be very, very careful there.
Well, Robert, you know, in addition to being a journalist at the New York Post, you are also a DJ and a stand-up comedian. So you're familiar with the world of hip-hop. I mean, do you think that somebody like Russell Simmons should be even considered a social activist, or is maybe that an awkward role for him?
Well, I think, generally speaking, just about anybody can call themselves a social activist. I think Simmons is certainly trying to do that. He's trying to get younger people involved in aware of social causes, politics, the Rockefeller drug laws here in New York, for example. Those kind of things. So I mean, and there's also a real tradition of African American leaders who start out in the entertainment world, sports world, and so forth, working pushing social causes. So I mean, you can't really necessarily criticize him for that, but I think he's going to have to realize that what's good for promotion of your company and yourself in hip hop, you have to reach a higher standard once you get into the political world and the social activist world.
And Farai is also going to cause also journalists to also, when he begins to say that we have 50, 100,000 people who are on our email database list and we attracted 20,000 people at a various rally, again, you're not going to necessarily take those at face value. You shouldn't anyway. But again, it's going to cause people, I think, to be sure to double check to make sure that is an accurate statement.
And remember, the numbers, some of these numbers actually started to come out during court cases, and that's always the case. And so he better keep Kimora very happy, because if she starts suing, we're going to find out exactly how much money he has.
How much bling he's got. Well, let me transition to another topic. Deborah, you've got a couple of young kids, and there's a University of Florida study that asks, what's in a name, along with Shakespeare? For a lot of black students with exotic names, apparently your ability to do well in school goes down. Teachers don't take you seriously. The study showed that a boy named Daquan was much more likely to score badly on reading and math tests than his sister, his biological sister, who would be named something like Deborah. So how did you make a choice about your kids, and what do you think of studies like this?
Well, I think studies like this are crucially important. In these days where racism is much more subtle and much more easily denied, and classism as well, having this kind of study, like the study with the resumes, the fake resumes with the black names and the white names, exactly the same except for black sounding names and white sounding names, and the black sounding names were 50% less likely to be called in for the jobs, that sort of thing. So it's crucial that we be able to specify exactly what's going on in the classroom, but what's the solution? Is the our ability to affect the kind of low income mothers who are giving their children these names is pretty low. Our ability to do that, and also, shouldn't we be able to call our children whatever we want to? So the work has got to be done in the classroom, and those of us who are out in, because it doesn't say here, it may be that black teachers as well expect less from Daquan.
Let me just jump in and throw in a totally different angle from the same study. Kids with Asian names actually ranked higher, not, you know, just based on ability,
right, but than their own siblings.
So you could name your next child, you know, Byling Dickerson, and, you know, see if there's any differential in the test scores. Well, Roland, you were about
to get into. I'm sorry. Some of these parents need to be smacked.
Yes, okay. Thank you. Roland, thank you very much.
When you name your child Lexus, Alizé, Schnapps, and see stupid club names, you need to be smacked in a second. Now, if you were really smart, maybe you'd name your child Aston, middle name Martin, maybe name them Bentley, Rolls, Royce, fine. You want to go with some names, but come on.
Some of these parents
are flat out crazy.
But these names
with
come
some
out
of
a
names.
Particular cultural milieu. And, you know, I named my children Dashiell and Caledonia. I'm a person who went, you know, I come from the black working class, but I went to Harvard Law School. I'm so unlikely to name my children Daquan because I understand how the world works and because I just have access to a different body of names. So the issue,
Deborah, the issue
has got to be to affect those mothers who dropped out of school. We've got to raise the level for everybody.
But Alizé,
but I mean, but yeah,
Lexus,
but when you,
come on.
And, but the, I
go ahead, Robert.
Also, I think also, and of course, we have to point out that our lovely host Farai today is an absolutely beautiful sounding name.
Oh well, thank you.
But I mean, I think what is very interesting here, it's not just a matter of scoring on tests. It says that if somebody has more of a European sounding name or a quote normal unquote name. That person will be suggested for, say, gifted programs more than the sibling that has a different name. I think we have to keep in mind that as much as we can try to let young women who are growing up and being educated, that. I mean, I think some of these names are just do sound silly. They sound fake. Quite frankly.
But should that affect their education?
Let me just jump in with this.
Go ahead.
Why do you think this happens? People have various theories on why people get extra creative with the names. And, you know, many people have theorized that it's a way of reclaiming a sense of creativity about your child. Isn't that a good thing?
But doesn't it come from the same impulse that makes you get those Fu Manchu fingernails with all the designs on them that are 10 inches long and the purple hair pieces? Isn't that of a piece with a part of the black psyche that is just very flamboyant?
Absolutely.
So it's not just the names.
It's the
Deborah,
presentation.
Some of the folks should do that ghetto. I mean, come on. Some of the folks. I mean, look, we just need to go. Look, cut to the chase.
You're all going to get letters from folks up in the hood saying, I like my fingernails. I like my weave. It's my hair. I bought it.
I'm not putting that down. I'm just saying the names don't happen in a vacuum. They can do that.
But there is, unfortunately, society makes certain kinds of judgments, and it's not just a case of white society. You know, I mean, I think you know some of our parents and some of our older siblings and so forth. When they look at some of the either young people's names and the fashions and things like that, it's not just an old fogeydom. I think they really do feel that some of these choices are almost separating.
I think it is old fogeydom. I'm so glad of this show because usually I'm always the one on the far right. Yay, I love today's show.
Well, you can always depend on me, Deborah.
Well, let me transition to our last topic. We got to get to this very quickly.
Years old, but if you're wearing a gold tooth, there's a good chance you're not going to be a TV anchor.
All right. Let me transition.
But it's fair.
Guys, time out.
Nothing
Supreme Court.
Is fair.
We got to move on to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court Speaking is looking at the Hogan, issue huh? of whether or not the Americans with Disabilities Act should be applied to prisoners. A lot of prisons are not compliant with the ADA. Now, if the government is held accountable for upgrading to serve disabled prisoners, is it just going to hurt taxpayers, or is this a much-needed reform that's really going to help everyone in the prison system?
I think it's gonna hit the taxpayers, but I think just in the context of the body of law, as the ADA has expanded. I mean, in fact, there's already a Supreme Court decision saying that the ADA does affect prisoners in other circumstances. I think it's gonna expand in there as well, which is quite frankly why many people have problems with the ADA when it was first put together, nearly 20 years ago now, I guess.
Well, I hope it does force us to look at the cost because maybe, first of all, a lot more states are examining the amount of dollars they're spending on prisons anyway and saying this whole 1980s, you know, decade attitude of law and order, throw everyone into prison. They're realizing that when you have these kinds of decisions, if indeed they rule in favor of the disabled prisoners, it is going to have a huge financial impact. Maybe it should cause us to examine why we build so many prisons at such a high cost, and should a lot of these folks actually be in prison versus being in other kinds of programs.
But the flip side of that, though, of course,
I just want to say this is George again.
This is Robert George again. Yeah, the flip side of that, of course, is that that law and order sensibility in the late 80s and into the early 90s helped produce a lower crime rates as well. I just need to put that on,
and also
on the
broke
table
state
too.
Budgets.
Well, Deborah, let me ask you, do you think that this, you know, if the prison costs spiral completely out of control, they're already quite high, do you think it will call for more reform?
Of the, if you mean more reform of our just criminal justice policies, is lock up as many people as hope we humanly as is humanly possible. I certainly do hope that we reform that and make it and actually dispense justice, as opposed to locking up, you know, a certain segment of the public that we deem basically criminal. But whatever our policy, once somebody ends up in jail, how can it? Why do we have to have a discussion about whether or not they need to be able to move around, whether or not they need to be able to go to the bathroom under their own power, to bathe themselves, to be able to turn their wheelchairs around in their cells? This is one of those things that's amazing to me that we have to have this conversation.
Well, but it's no different than what took place when Justice Wayne Watson, Wayne Justice in Texas, when he took over the Texas prison system, because so many people have an attitude of they don't need anything that we have in our society. We sort of have this cannibalistic attitude, just thrown they're nothing, they're terrible, every single one
they're
of
less
them,
than
the
human,
heck with
them,
less than human, and so therefore we, and then we also say, well, why didn't this person get reformed, but then we don't want to provide educational services or counseling services in prison.
Right.
And the lowest common denominator in us as a society.
Well, Robert, we've only got a couple seconds left, but how does this all play out into the issue of partisan politics? A lot of people have criticized the growing private prison industry. Do you think that private prisons are going to be more or less likely to bear these costs than the public ones?
Well, I think there's a possibility of that, but I think the irony here is that I'm not necessarily sure if this is going to be completely a partisan issue, because something that's been sort of flown under the radar of late is that there's a growing segment coming actually from the Christian right to start reforming some prisons, because their interpretation of the Bible is the feeling that they need to help their fellow man there. So their prison, there is some prison reform, there's a push for prison reform coming from the right as well. So that might play into this as well.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time.
James Dobson, try something on that one.
All right. We're going to keep an eye on all these issues. And that was Robert George, editorial writer for the New York Post, Deborah Dickerson, author of The End of Blackness at WG.
Alizé Rowland.
Alizé. Yeah, exactly. She's at WGY Studios.
Ashton Rowland, sir.
Albany, New York. You guys are cracking me up. And Bentley Alizé Rowland Martin, executive editor of the Chicago Defender.
Fry, we just loved having you on, Fry.
Thanks very much. All right.
Thank you.